Madam?
She's British, Decker said. She's not young, and so I'm pretty sure she has seen that ghastly old film, Midnight Express. Oh, the one where the nasty Turks rape and murder everything that moves, she said. Don't lay a finger on her, but play up to it. Play, oh, use your imagination, Suleiman, Tekir said. Walk her past the cells. They're busy at the moment. Still full of protesters from the very first days of Gezi. Throw some old cigarette ends around in one of the older interview rooms and break a chair. You have my permission. Tell her, Tekir said, just how long it can take to bring a case to court in this country and just where people are held while they are waiting. No blood was visible. The floor of what the Erol girls had called the outhouse was covered in oil, feces, and probably, from the smell of it, urine. Blood was almost certainly there. The whole area would need to be treated with luminol. Not that, apart from providing support to the girls' story, blood was needed. A DNA swab had already been taken from inside the child's mouth, which would be compared to Ariadne Sava's results. Maternity would be proven, or otherwise, in a few days. Kerim Gürsel showed his ID to the constables at the entrance and joined his boss. "This used to be a garage," he said. "Did it belong to the house next door?" Ekmen asked. "Yes." The old wooden house on the right was derelict. "A Jewish family lived there until about 10 years ago, when they moved to Israel," Kerim said. "They had one of those old American cars they used to keep in here." "Did the Bakal owner know who owns the house now?" Ekmen asked. Across the road from the outhouse was a neighborhood grocer store, or Bakal. People who ran such places generally knew everything about their local area. "He says he thinks it's the original family. They had money, apparently, and when they went to Israel, they just left the house to rot," Kerim said. "Get a name?" "Yes, sir, Nabaru. Recep Bey, in the Bakal, says that kids are always having to be chased out of this place, and the house. He also said that working girls ply their trade here." One of the reasons Ekmen had chosen Kerim to be his sergeant was because he always spoke about everyone with respect. Most officers he knew would have described the prostitutes who worked the area as whores or slags, but not Kerim. Then, perhaps now, he knew why. "So we mustn't get too excited," Ekmen said. "The child could belong to almost anyone." "But he is the right sort of age, sir." "Indeed. And I will inform Mr. Sava that a child has been found. But I will impress upon him the possibility of disappointment." He looked around the building. "I wonder how many other children have been conceived, born, or dumped in this place. And I wonder what the Errol sisters and their grandmother thought they were going to do with the child," Kerim said. Ekmen had briefly been to see the grandmother before he arrived at the crime scene. A more outspoken old secular Republican woman it would have been hard to imagine. But then that made sense. In the cities, it was generally the under-60s who were religious. The old people had seen that long ago and rejected it. "The old woman just wanted to save a prostitute's baby," Ekmen said. "Wanted to try and bring it up without, as she put it, stigma and superstition." "Sounds very liberal." "She is," Ekmen said. "Obviously her granddaughters don't take after her." Ekmen laughed. "Oh, don't you be so sure. And don't be fooled by the covering. Muslims Against Capitalism, the group they belong to, want to completely change society. And they embrace all colors, races and creeds. They are radical people. The Errol's grandmother must be proud." Then he turned towards a group of officers who had been waiting patiently at the back of the old garage. "Okay, the scene is yours," he said to Kerim. "Let's go and look at the Svendon again." The forensic team began setting up their equipment as Ekmen and Kerim Gürsel walked out into the sunshine. Ekmen lit a cigarette. "I noticed that Mr. Erden wasn't outside the Negroponte house when I drove past," he said. "Maybe his more recent travails are taking up his time."
"With Inspector Suleiman?"
"Yes." They walked the short distance to the Svendon in silence. It was very close. A baby could easily have been taken from the ancient hippodrome and placed in the Jewish family's outhouse. For someone light on their feet, it was the work of seconds. On the other hand, lack of any further evidence in the Svendon was underlining Inkman's growing belief that Ariadne had given birth elsewhere before she had entered the ancient space. Still cordoned off, the Svendon was guarded by a constable, who asked Inkman if he wanted to go inside. He said no. He'd seen what he needed to see. Inkman and Kerim walked back to their cars in silence, Inkman thinking about the short conversation he'd had with his cousin Samson early that morning. Breathless and overcome with excitement, she'd said, "Oh, Chetin, I promised not to tell, but I just can't keep it to myself any longer. I went to Gezi, and I met this lovely trans girl called Rita, American. Well, she introduced me to this other trans girl who was having a thing with your Sergeant Gusel." Inkman hadn't been shocked, but he had been surprised. "Kerim is married," he said. "To a lesbian, yes," Samson had replied. "Chetin, the wife is a beard, a disguise to hide what your sergeant really is. He likes chicks with dicks. Chetin, trust me, and his wife, ill little thing, well, she likes girls. Now you won't tell him I told you, will you? I promised his lover that I wouldn't tell anyone, so she mustn't find out I've told you." Then she'd put the phone down. Inkman looked at Kerim as he got into his car. "See you back at the station."
"Yes, sir."
When Kerim had driven off, Inkman sat quietly for a moment, thinking. Samson had a lot of faults, but lying wasn't one of them, and so he had no doubt whoever these people she'd met in Gezi were, she had believed them. Inkman had personally never met Kerim's wife. She had rheumatoid arthritis and was an invalid. Was she also a lesbian? It wasn't his business, unless for some reason Kerim's unusual lifestyle, if in fact he had one, impacted on his work. But Inkman knew that it could. Some officers were very punitive when it came to transgendered people and would arrest them for the slightest infraction of the law, real or imagined. He wouldn't tell Kerim what he knew, yet. But if he needed to sometime in the future, in order to protect him, he would break Samson's confidence. But then, for all her protestations, Inkman knew that she had to know that. Being back in Dr. Inchi's dental surgery a second time was unnerving. Just sitting in the waiting room made Ermengun wonder whether that dull ache he had at the back of his mouth was a sign that one of his teeth was rotting. Then she called him in. They shook hands. "Thank you for coming," she said. "It's so difficult for me to find a few free minutes." "It's no problem." "Please sit down," she directed him to a stool at a bench in front of a light box. She sat down next to him and then clipped an X-ray slide in front of the light box. "This is the X-ray of your Galatasaray victim's mouth that was taken by your forensic people," she said. He was familiar with it.
"Yes."
She took the slide down. "The plate I'm going to show you now was loose in a drawer, so I don't know who it might have belonged to. We'll talk about that in a moment," she said. "But it is the closest match I found to your X-ray." She held an old glass X-ray plate up to the light box and then clipped the new X-ray back to the box. "You see, this molar here has been crowned, and there's a bridge across from the right central incisor, across the gap where the maxillary right lateral incisor should be, to the maxillary right canine. You may also notice that the bridge unit is canted slightly to the left." Uma couldn't really see it. Mouths were mouths, and the old plate was very hard to decipher. "However, I've also done some measurement comparisons and looked specifically at distances between teeth and fillings. I can't say for certain, because, as I said, I don't have a name here, but I think this plate probably relates to your Galatasaray man's dental work. Now, with regard to identification, you will see something in the top left-hand corner." There was what looked like a series of scratches and a smudge. Uma narrowed his eyes. He heard her laugh. "Oh, don't even try to see what it is," she said. "I've had it under my most powerful microscope, and I can't see a thing." He looked up. "But," she said, "I have an idea."
"Which is?"
"Your forensic people," she said. "I don't know whether their equipment will be able to find something I can't, but I think you should give it a try." Omer put the plate carefully into a storage box Dr. Inchi let him have. He made a note of the resolution of the dentist's microscope and left. Suleiman finally got Mary Cox into police headquarters at 7 o'clock in the evening. She'd been out with her charge, Kelime, all day, and because Ahmet Erdin had been elsewhere, organizing care for the young girl had taken time. He took her into a room just like the one Tekir had described. He'd enjoyed smoking in an interview room again. He'd appreciated smashing up a few chairs even more. Her face, as she walked in front of him, quickly showed her disgust. She said,
"In here?"
"Sit down," he said. A female constable, large and expressionless, walked in behind him. He knew her name, Özal, but not much else, except that she boxed. She also very easily elicited fear. When Mary Cox saw Özal, her eyes visibly widened.
"Stand at the door," Suleiman said to Özal.
"Sir?"
He sat down opposite Mary Cox and lit a cigarette.
"Mary," he said, "Miss Cox."
"Yes?"
"Citizen of Great Britain, 50 years old. Single."
"Yes?"
He said nothing. He didn't even look at her, not directly.
She said, "What do you want, Inspector Suleiman?"
"You have a permit to work in Turkey?"
"Yes," she said, "you have that. You have my passport, too."
He'd taken her British passport from her when she'd arrived. Foreign nationals always felt vulnerable without their passports, particularly the British.
"Do I need to contact someone from my consulate?" she asked.
Although the grim surroundings were clearly not to her taste, she seemed to be adapting and was showing very little fear.
"I want you to tell me what happened the night before last," he said.
"I told you, Kelime was ill. Mr. Erdin stayed with her. All night."
"During which time you didn't sleep once."
"I told you, I don't believe you," he said.
"Why stay awake all night if the father of the child is sleeping in her room? Do you not trust Mr. Erdin with his daughter?"
Her face flushed.
"What do you mean?"
"Do you think Mr. Erdin is some kind of idiot that he can't look after his own child?"
"No."
"Then why stay awake?"
Her eyes moved very quickly from his face, to the floor, to the filthy table. Suleiman dropped cigarette ash on the floor. Mary Cox sniffed.
"Do you mind?"
"No. No, I don't mind, Miss Cox, at all," he said. "And now I say again, why stay awake? Is there something you wish to tell me about your employer and the sexual abuse of his daughter?"
"No. No, Mr. Erdin would never do anything like that," Mary said. "He's a good man, a moral man."
"With a mistress, she used to take her clothes off for men to look at her body," Suleiman said. "We have photographs of him with this woman."
"They are entirely fake," she said.
Suleiman looked at her. There was possibly something more in that rebuttal than just admiration.
"Did he tell you that?" Suleiman asked.
"No, I haven't spoken to Mr. Erdin about any of this," she said.
"He must have spoken to you about what you said to us."
She looked a little confused for a moment. Then she said,
"Well, yes, I suppose so."
"Did you, or didn't you?"
"Yes."
"So?"
"So what?" "I told Mr. Erdin I told you the truth, which is that I was awake all night," she said. "I didn't see Mr. Erdin or anyone else leave the house."
He sat back in his chair and crossed his arms.
"You would have me believe that you sat up all night when the sick child in your care was peacefully asleep and with her loving father. What did you have to worry about under such circumstances?"
"I wanted to be available in case Mr. Erdin needed help."
"What help would he need? The child wasn't seriously ill. Some minor sickness. According to you and Mr. Erdin, she asked for her father to sleep in her room. The impression I have been given is that Kelime Erden is somewhat spoilt.
She is Mr. Erden's only child,
who has Down's syndrome.
Yes, which is all the more reason to monitor her health very carefully.
I do not know about that.
Well, he held up a hand to silence her.
Miss Cox, whatever implications that may have, I am still not satisfied that you remained awake all night for no reason. I am not happy that Mr. Erden slept alone in his daughter's bedroom. Her face went purple.
He'd never do anything like that to Kelime. He's a good man.
A good man who uses a prostitute, Suleiman said. A good man who may have a secret life of vice. I can accept that you didn't know about his mistress, but I cannot believe that you were happy about his presence in Kelime's room if you really didn't take a sleeping tablet. I looked at your tablets myself, and you have many. They are prescribed for every night. You clearly have a problem. You must have to take sleep whenever you can, whenever you don't have to watch Kelime Erden. On the night in question, you didn't take a pill, which has to mean that you felt that you couldn't. I am asking you why. She didn't reply. Miss Cox, the law here works in some ways just like it does in Britain. If someone has to wait to be tried for a crime, they are kept in prison until their court appearance. That includes assisting a criminal. What is different here, according to my understanding of your prisons, is that ours are much more old-fashioned. Life is hard if you don't have someone outside to bring in proper food for you. There is a system of barter amongst prisoners, and guards can be... Well, I'm sure you have heard how guards can be. Mary Cox still said nothing. He hoped she had not just tuned out, and was actually thinking through her options. Whatever you may feel for a person, if they have broken the law, you must forget that. She took in a deep breath.
I feel nothing for Mr. Erden but respect.
Suleiman knew he hadn't done what Tekere had asked him to. He hadn't screamed at her or evoked visceral terror. Once inside the interview room, it hadn't felt right for her. Maybe it was because her response to her surroundings had been muted. She was tougher than she looked. Only one thing might get through to her, and he raised that issue again. I wish I could agree with you, he said, but I can't. Miss Cox, I am not happy with your explanation about the events of that night. And although it does not make me happy to have to do this, I feel I must speak to Kelime Erden. This time her skin went white.
Kelime? But she's just a child.
Yes, he said. A child who it is my duty as a police officer to protect.
Mr. Erden wouldn't abuse Kelime. He wouldn't.
She got to her feet.
Why are you trying to accuse him of doing things he hasn't done?
Sit down. She didn't. Constable Özal began to move towards her. Mary Cox sat. Listen to me, Miss Cox, Suleiman said. A woman is dead. A woman who was Mr. Erden's mistress. We don't know whether he killed her or not, but at the moment he has an alibi. You. Now, in my judgment, there is something wrong in the stories I have been told. One of them is definitely wrong. Mr. Erden told me he didn't know the dead woman when he did. He told me he was in his daughter's room all night. So I am thinking, is he lying about that? Are you lying about that? And if you are not, why did you stay awake, if you stayed awake?
I did.
He shrugged. And if that is the case, I will have to speak to Kelime Erden.
No, you'll frighten her.
Suleiman leaned across the dirty table towards her and said, Then I suggest we take you home and you think about your options tonight. It's late now. We will start our conversation again in the morning, when maybe you will have slept, and maybe you will not.
Chapter 19.
Aelin Archeldas looked down at the partial skeleton she and Ariadne Sava had called Paleologos, and said, "Thank you for letting me see him." Professor Bozdar shrugged. "He's still yours," he said. "Once I got over not being told, I realized that."
"Thank you."
The broken sword was at his side. Robbed of its jewels, it looked violated, but it still dazzled her. Its provenance was still a mystery, like the body. Maybe it would remain a mystery forever.
"What about the threats for you?" Professor Bozdar asked. She looked up.
"Oh, they still keep coming," she said.
"Do the police have any idea where they're coming from?"
"No. Their experts think that whoever is sending them is routing them through servers they've hijacked, abroad."
"And the letters?"
"Nothing," she said. "No identifying features found so far. They know what they're doing."
"But it seems that if they're still sending you threats, they don't know that our friend is here."
They both looked down at the skeleton.
"Which is the way we have to keep it," Aelin said. "Can you imagine what people like that would do to him?"
The professor shook his head.
"And yet, who is he? Are you sure Dr. Sava never told you who she was going to attempt the DNA comparison with?"
"I'm certain," she said. "And believe me, I've looked at every item of documentation that passed between us. There's nothing."
"They're sick. Measles."
Suleiman looked at the man who said he was a doctor, and then asked to see his ID card.
"Mr. Erdin called me this morning,"
the man who was indeed Dr. Akurgal said.
"This now explains why Kelemi Erdin was sick 2 days ago."
"Does it?"
"Yes."
He looked at Umar Mungun, who he noticed had an expression of cynicism on his face, which pleased him. The boy was learning.
"Well, I need to speak to Mary Cox," Suleiman said. "Mary Hanum is too ill to speak to anyone, and this house is quarantined."
"I've had measles," Suleiman said.
"Sergeant Mungun?"
"Oh, I've had it too, sir."
He looked at the doctor.
"Step aside, sir."
And then Ahmed Erdin appeared.
"What do you want this time, Suleiman?" he said. "You bullied my nanny last night. Now you come back to do it all over again. Well, she's sick, and so is my daughter. Miss Cox told you what she knows last night, and by the way, if you do want to talk to my daughter, you will have to do so in the presence of Dr. Akurgal and my lawyer, and only when she is better. If you want to speak to Miss Cox again, then I suggest you charge her with something. I've already spoken to the British consulate on her behalf this morning. I expect that Commissioner Tekke will be hearing from them very soon."
Tekke, who had ordered him to get tough with Mary Cox. Suleiman felt himself deflate. Together with Umar Mungun, he'd driven out to Bebek because Mary Cox hadn't arrived at the station at 9 a.m. as agreed. All attempts at calling her had failed, and now this, thwarted on Erdin's doorstep.
"Miss Cox didn't have any sort of rash I could discern yesterday evening," Suleiman said.
"It came on overnight,"
the doctor said. Between them, Erdin and this doctor had, and would have, answers to every objection Suleiman might make.
"I was here all night when that woman died in Moda," Erdin said, "just like Mary Cox said. Just like my daughter would tell you if I ever let you near her, which I will not. And don't think that those disgusting suggestions you made to Mary will be forgotten, because they won't. Now go away and allow me to look after my sick child in peace."
They left. For a minute or so, Suleiman drove in silence. Then he pulled the car over into an unmade rural lane, put his head back, and closed his eyes.
"Bloody bastard!"
Irma Mungun, accustomed to the occasional outburst from his superior, could nevertheless understand this one.
"His fingerprints are all over that apartment. We know he lied about knowing that woman," he said.
Suleiman opened his window and lit a cigarette.
"But did he kill her?" "In a way,
Knowing that he was having a relationship with her for certain isn't helping. When he does confess to his affair with Mrs. Urgell, which he will, he'll say he was there off and on all the time. He will do anything to save his own skin in the end. Miss Mary, on the other hand, will, I believe, do anything she has to help him. Why? Why do you think? He's a good-looking man, and so she's convinced herself she believes his holy man act. Oh. Suleiman smoked. Ah, but Miss Mary and the girl can't be ill forever. You think they're really ill? No. But it's a clever delaying tactic, and involving the British consulate was smart. As if these people didn't have enough pull already with those at the top of the food chain. He shook his head. You know, Uma, I look at this city and...
Erden!
Uma pointed to his right. What?
That was Erden's car. It just went towards the city,
Uma said. Suleiman started his engine and roared out onto the road ahead.
You sure?
The driver of a Porsche slammed on his brakes, narrowly missing a shunt from a Mercedes behind.
As much as I can be.
A Land Rover was three cars in front of them, but neither of them could see the license plate. They followed, Uma Mungun trying to find some vantage point that would allow him to see the back of the Land Rover properly. But this didn't happen until they reached a set of traffic lights. Suleiman stopped the car, and Uma jumped out. Seconds later, he was back inside Suleiman's BMW again, and he was smiling.
It's definitely him, sir.
Suleiman shook his head. What a caring father he is, eh? Fatma had gone to pray at that space behind Hagia Sophia again, and so Eichmann was in a bad mood. Why do you want to pray amongst lunatics? He'd asked her before he left the house that morning. You know the people who go there only do it to piss off the Christians, don't you?
No, they don't, she'd said. They are sincerely religious men and women.
Oh, yes, he'd retorted. The type of sincerely religious men and women who like to make big shows of themselves dressed for the desert that we don't, you might have noticed, live in. They're bigots and fanatics, and if I were in any way like one of their men, I'd forbid you from going there. Fatma had just laughed. And your laughter at such an absurd idea just goes to prove my point, Eichmann had said. I'm not like them, and you couldn't cope with me if I was. Fanatical religion is all very well and good as a notion, Fatma. But at heart, you're just too liberal. If you're not, I don't know why we're still married. Then he'd slammed the apartment door behind him. But the altercation, plus lack of sleep, had left him agitated. Now that Gezi had moved far beyond Taksim and out to every open space across the city, the police had been ordered to move in again. There had been altercations in the night, and Chetin and Fatma's son Kemal hadn't got home until the early hours of the morning. He'd had a bruise on his back the size of a dessert plate. Chetin didn't ask him who had made it. He knew a plastic bullet bruise when he saw one. All he'd done was tell the boy to go to the doctor to get it checked. But Kemal had said,
There's loads of doctors at Gizzy, Dad. I've already had it looked at. It's fine.
But it wasn't. Chetin had hoped that maybe the younger children would grow up in a country not plagued by factional violence. Now that military coups were a thing of the past, that should be possible. But clearly it wasn't. Gezi was an amazing phenomenon, and he could only applaud its liberal, ecumenical spirit. But he feared for it, and everyone associated with it. He switched his computer on and looked through his emails. Another request for Mr. Sava to take his daughter's body back to Greece. He'd only spoken to him the previous day to tell him about the baby the Erol girls had found. His response had been one of pessimism, which was probably for the best. Results from the IT investigators were inconclusive on the source of Aylin Akyoldiz's threatening emails. And then there was one from Professor Bozdar at the museum. It just said, Re you're looking for as yet undiscovered Byzantine structures in the old city. Shows where some of the old tunnels might be. There was an attachment, which, when opened, revealed a map of Sultan Ahmed, hand-drawn, indistinct and small. It was written in French, and was dated 1895. They tried to stall him by first offering him lemonade in that hot, icon-stuffed salon of theirs, and then they took him upstairs to go into the old woman's bedroom. He didn't want to see her. He could hear her breathing, and he wished she wouldn't. With her gone, it would be so much easier. But standing by her bedside table, full of her brushes, her pills, and her very modest bits and pieces, was a good opportunity, and one he hadn't imagined he would get. He'd never dreamed they would let him see her. Then he said, "I want to go downstairs. You must know that."
"I offered you a tour of my house, and so that's what you'll get."
Yanis Negroponte was enjoying making him wait. He knew what was down there, and so did that old hulker who followed him everywhere like a dog. Three more bedrooms, a hammam, and old man Negroponte's study had to be gone through before they descended to the basement. Then it was the toilet, a cupboard full of jars of preserved fruits and vegetables from decades back. And then, finally, they walked into the kitchen. Ahmet Erden held his breath. For a moment he couldn't move his head at all. Frozen in a forwards position, even his eyes couldn't move, from a scene that was entirely not as he had remembered it. And then, when he could move, what he saw was even more alien. Where had the great stone blocks in the walls gone? Where was the entrance arch on the left? The step down just in front of it, the door that had been made out of rough plasterboard, just open enough for him to see.
"Where is it?"
he said.
"Where's what?"
Yanis replied.
"You know."
He saw Yanis and the old man exchange the quickest of glances, and for a moment he felt his head swim.
"I don't have to tell you, you know,"
he roared.
"Know what?"
"This is my kitchen, which you wanted to see. I'm showing it to you." He put a hand up to the wall and scratched it with his fingers. Yanis Negroponte pulled his hand away.
"Please don't damage my kitchen, Mr. Erden."
Ahmet paced. Backwards two steps, forwards, sideways. Whichever way he moved, it was still the same. It wasn't right.
"What have you done?"
he hissed.
"Have you destroyed it yourselves? Have you covered it up somehow? Where have you hidden it?"
"Hidden what?" His blood pressure had to be through the roof. He knew they knew, even if they wouldn't say it. And he couldn't. The words were in his head, but they just wouldn't come out of his mouth. He leapt forwards to grab that faux Greek's neck, but he sidestepped him.
"What have you done?" he said. "How have you concealed it? Is it one of your tricks? An illusion? Or have you truly bewitched me with your ungodly magic? If you have bewitched me, I will make sure that you are pursued to your death as a false prophet."
"I have neither," he sweated. They were laughing at him, like a pair of hook-nosed demons. Ahmet wanted to kill them. "Whatever you thought you were going to find in my kitchen isn't here," Yanis said.
"Which implies you know."
"I don't know anything. My kitchen is my kitchen, as it is, as it always has been."
"This is true," the old man said. Was he going mad, or were they really toying with him?
The fact that the faux Greek had invited him in at all had to indicate the latter. But what could he do about it? "I'm sorry my kitchen hasn't lived up to your standards," Yanis said. "But then you don't have to buy the house. It's not even for sale. There's no obligation." He wanted to throw himself on the man and rip his heart out, but he couldn't move again. Instead, he spoke.
"Well, don't get too comfortable, Yanis," he said, "because in a few days' time, I will know exactly who you are, and so will everyone else."
For the first time, Yanis Negroponte's face tensed.
"I am Yanis Negroponte. I am..." "Remember that night we talked sitting outside your gate," Ahmet said, "when I took your hand and dug my fingers into your flesh?"
Yanis didn't reply, but he had to remember it.
"You probably thought that was just spite, but you were wrong," Ahmet said. "I took your blood and the flesh that was inside my fingernails, and I sent it off for DNA analysis.
You know they can tell everything these days from DNA. They can even tell what race you belong to.
Was it just his imagination, or did the room move just a little then?
But Ahmet Erden didn't stop to find out. He turned away from Yanis and the old man, and he left.
He came out half an hour later, Suleiman said. Then what did he do?
Got in his car and drove off towards Sirkeci.
Suleiman and Duma Mungun were in Çetin İkmen's office with the inspector and Kerim Gürsel.
You didn't follow him?
İkmen said. I'd had a call from Tekke by then, Suleiman said. The biggest back-off I can recall.
He's an important man, Kerim said. Who lies?
Suleiman shrugged his shoulders.
When we left him, he was so worried about his daughter, he implied he could barely leave her side. But within minutes, he's on his way to the Negroponte house.
Who let him in? İkmen said. A middle-aged man, sallow, unhealthy-looking.
Yanis, madam's son.
İkmen frowned.
Why?
You mean because they're at odds? Suleiman said. I've no idea.
I'll call them, İkmen said. Yanis knows we're watching his house and Erden. What did Erden look like when he came out? Did he look pleased? Defeated?
Angry, I'd say, Umar Mungun said. His face was red, and when he got into his car, he slammed the door behind him.
İkmen put his phone on speaker so they could all hear the conversation, and dialed the Negroponte's number.
Yanis answered. Yanis, it's Inspector İkmen. Noticed that Ahmet Erden was at your house this morning. Is everything all right?
Oh, yes, he said. Fine.
Just a little curious why he would be inside your house, İkmen said. Did he pressure you to let him in?
No.
Then you know how much in need of repair this place is, Çetin Bey, Yanis said. He's been offering such enormous sums of money, I thought that if he saw the state of the place, he might go off the idea.
And did he?
No,
he sighed.
It's the location, Yanis, in the heart of the old city, İkmen said.
I know.
But you and Madame and Hakka are all right?
Oh, yes, he said. Mr. Erden came. He saw, and he still wanted to buy, and I still turned him down. He wasn't happy when he left here.
Let me know if he comes back, and if you need help, İkmen said.
Thank you, Çetin Bey.
İkmen put the phone down. He appears to be in good spirits.
Erden was in his domain, Suleiman said. Whatever designs he may have on that house, it belongs to Yanis and his mother, and they have the power.
That's true.
Erden, however, had the power when Umar and I went to see him this morning, Suleiman said.
About his dead mistress in Moda,
indirectly. We think that his alibi for that night is unsound, Umar Mungun said.
Who or what is his alibi?
His daughter's nanny, Suleiman said. I have an unpleasant notion that she may be in love with him.
İkmen shook his head. It never ceases to amaze me the people other people fall in love with, he said.
Suleiman looked away. I even wonder whether Erden could be the father of Ariadne Sava's child, İkmen said. She was supposedly his enemy, but I don't see any other men in her life, and if that did happen, she wouldn't be the first woman to fall in love with a man she thinks she hates.
Maybe he raped her, Kerim said.
That, too, is possible.
He turned to Suleiman. I imagine you've heard that we found a baby boy who may or may not be Dr. Sava's child. DNA and time will tell. What would also be useful is a sample from Mr. Erden.
Suleiman grimaced.
Ah. İkmen shook his head. Yes, of course you haven't been allowed to get that far, have you? Any forensics from other people possibly at the scene? One partial fingerprint, not on our records, and some as yet unidentified hair strands. But they could be Erden's.
Which means you'll have to take DNA eventually.
When I'm allowed, yes.
İkmen nodded. I think that we both need to go and see the commissioner to make our need for Mr. Erden's compliance known, he said. Not that I think for a moment she isn't aware of it. I'm sure she is, and I'm also sure that she has already done everything those above her are permitting her to do. We've always lived in strange times, because this is Turkey, and strange is what we do. But I must admit that much of what is happening now makes me more fearful for the future than I have ever been. And yet the nation has never been so economically powerful. He smiled. Is it the country, or me, who was wrong, do you think? Ahmed Erdin put his phone down and walked out of his office, down a flight of stairs and into his kitchen. His cook, a Chechen, looked at him with expressionless eyes. "Cook for Miss Mary and my daughter as usual tonight," he said. "But not for me. I'm eating out." "Yes, Ahmed Bey." He left. On the stairs back to the first floor, he met Mary Cox. He noticed that she blushed.
"Ah, Mr. Erdin."
"Mary?"
"I've, Kelly is watching TV and wants some ice cream. I've come down to,
"Oh, please." He stepped out of her way. Mary moved past him. He said, "You know I can't tell you how much I appreciate what you're doing for me and for Kelly, Mary. I am sure that your consulate will complain about Inspector Suleiman in the strongest terms." She looked up at him and smiled.
"It's nothing," she said. "You're innocent. You told me where you were the night that woman died, Mr. Erdin, and I believe you. But I also understand why you can't say any of that to the police. I couldn't believe how set against you they are."
"I am successful, and I'm a man of faith," he said. "The old police guard don't like that. But times are changing. The police are changing." He began to walk away. "Oh, and thank you for having measles for me."
"It's no problem. I know you'll do right by me, Mr. Erdin. Always."
"Of course." He saw her smile, and he smiled back. But once back in his office, Ahmed Erdin's smile faded. Could he trust her? Probably she was besotted with him. But what had she meant by always? Chapter 20. The dervish was slim and tall, and so he was probably young. He wore a gas mask, which covered his head and face, shrouding his identity. But it was his entari, the wide-skirted robe that all Mevlevi dervishes wore, that was most dramatic. Unlike the traditional white entari, this one was green and made of velvet, and as he turned in the dying evening light, he was followed by an ever-growing crowd of photographers, grizzled academics, children, students, and Samsun Bayraktar, Çetin İkmen's cousin. Earlier in the day, she'd met up with İkmen's youngest son, Kemal, who had showed her the deep bruising on his back due to a police-issue plastic bullet. Knowing that Çetin's wife, Fatman, had to be losing her mind at the thought of what the boy was doing, she tried to persuade him to go home. It wouldn't be long before the police moved in again, and she wanted Kemal to be safe. But he wouldn't go. He'd hung around with her all day, getting ice creams, finding water, and talking to her friend Madonna about politics. In her previous incarnation as a bookish young man called Hakan, Madonna had been a student of political science at Boğaziçi University. That had been back in the 1980s, before Hakan had discovered men and drag, and become the Lady Madonna, beloved of several thousand clubbers across Istanbul.
"It's a lovely movement there,"
Madonna said, as they followed the dervish as he whirled across Taksim Square.
"Yes, but he's probably very religious, so don't get your hopes up," Samsun said.
"I think it's amazing the way people from all across the religious secular divide have come here to do this," Kemal said. "That's why I keep on coming back. I wish Mum would come. If she would, she'd be able to see that no one here is anti-religion."
"Except her,"
Samson said, pointing to Madonna.
"I'm not anti," Madonna said.
She lit a cigarette and took a swig from a can of Coke.
"People can believe whatever they like. Just don't try and get me to believe it too, because I won't."
The dervish stayed in one place, whirling on the spot, his head turned towards heaven, the wide skirt of his entari putting space between himself and those who watched him, ensuring his privacy as he communed with God. And although his performance wasn't accompanied by music, it was hypnotic. Samson had even heard somewhere that watching dervishes dance lowered your blood pressure. She hoped so, because hers had been right up for the last few days. One of the things that had led up to Gezi had been the issue of lesbian, gay, transgendered, and bisexual rights. A lot of people wanted to extend them, and this included elements within the government. But the more conservative members of parliament had been against it, and they were in the majority. Samson didn't know whether Gezi would help the community to achieve more equality or not. But she feared that if the protest was crushed, the hope of more parity would be destroyed along with it. As the sun went down, the three of them watched the young dervish dance, and felt better for doing so. Arm in arm, the young man with one middle-aged and one old transsexual woman on each side. The journey took forever, what with the clubs that lined the Bosphorus, the Gezi Park protest, and all the other smaller demonstrations all over the city. Traffic going into the center of Istanbul was at times gridlocked. When the taxi got to Otaköy, where there were a lot of clubs, it stopped for over half an hour. Ahmet Erden was glad he'd left so much time to get to his assignation. He looked out of the cab window at a group of barely clad girls waiting for their friends outside a club called Machine. To him they summed up the complacency and corruption of the secular elite. Much as he disagreed with the kids in Gezi Park, at least they were there for a reason, albeit a misguided one. He gave the cab driver an extra 20 lira and told him to try the back streets when he could. He did, but it didn't improve things. It still took over an hour to get to Sultan Ahmet. The hippodrome was dark and almost deserted. What tourists there were wandered in ones and twos, and there were no police on duty at all. Ahmet sat down on a bench and looked at the Egyptian obelisk. He found it confusing. Always heard. When he'd been alive, his father had hated it. There were carvings down the four sides that represented false gods. But his grandfather had loved it. His father and his grandfather had not got on. His grandfather had always believed that his father had been converted to an extreme religious ideology by a group of Arabs he'd met just after the Second World War. Refugees from Syria who had come across the Turkish border looking for work. They'd been full of fear and hatred for all the Jews that had been arriving in Palestine. Ahmet could remember his father railing against the Jews when he was a child. He wouldn't even believe that the Holocaust had taken place at all, a view which, at the time, was considered irrational and mad. No, it was common. Ahmet knew several otherwise sensible people who subscribed to it. He couldn't. The Jews had died in those camps. Surely people who denied it had to know there was no way the Holocaust could have been a fragment of the imagination. Surely even his father had to have known that. The old man had been dead for nearly 20 years, but Ahmet still felt compelled to please him. He'd wanted the Negroponte house and its secret ever since Ahmet could remember. But that had been after 1955, when everyone had become nervous about Greeks and what happened to them in the city. In the 21st century, things were different again. Ahmet wanted a cigarette. It was the first time he'd thought about them for years. As a young man, he'd hidden his smoking from his father, who didn't approve of any sort of addiction. Now, in his exalted position as one of Istanbul's most successful property developers, and as a pillar of the community, smoking wasn't appropriate. Just as having a mistress hadn't been appropriate either.
Ahmet Bey!
And here, at last, was the man he had come to meet. Old and arthritic, he walked a lot more slowly out in the open than he did in the house. "Good evening, Akabey," he said. "I'm glad you've come to your senses." The great palace of the Byzantines was what had stood on the Sultan Ahmet Peninsula before the Turkish invasion of 1453. Together with Hagia Sophia, it was a complex of buildings, rather than just one vast palace. It meant that in one relatively small area, the Byzantine emperors and their families could live, work, worship, and even watch games at the Hippodrome. But because assassination was a real possibility for so many Byzantine rulers, tunnels were dug that led between significant parts of the complex. That way the Emperor and his family could pass from building to building in safety. The map Professor Bosdar had emailed him, originally drawn by a Monsieur René Goudiquet, was small and hard to read. But Goudiquet had clearly been very interested in mapping sites of Byzantine structures. Some were known, like Hagia Sophia and Hagia Irene, but back in those days only fragments of the great palace had been excavated. Not a great deal had changed in the intervening time, but what was thought to be the palace library had been discovered on a site next to the Four Seasons Hotel, and a few small chapels had been located in Jankutaran. It was nearly midnight, but Professor Bosdar had told Ikmen to call him if he wanted any more information or had questions. Whether he, like Ikmen, was still in his office was open to question, but he answered his mobile phone immediately. He was even jovial. Maybe he was lonely?
René Goudiquet wasn't a Byzantine scholar, just an amateur enthusiast, he said. You know, rich people from Western Europe, Britain, France, Germany, used to do what they called the Grand Tour. This was a trip into antique, usually poor lands like Italy, Greece, and parts of the Ottoman Empire, generally Constantinople, Egypt, and Palestine. For almost nothing they could travel in style and eat like kings, while fooling themselves they were becoming very cultured. Most of them just got sunburn and food poisoning, but a few fell in love with this part of the world. Goudiquet was one of them. Spent his life walking the streets of Sultan Ahmed, looking for signs of the great palace. He never found it, of course.
So his map is speculative?
In part. The Sultan Ahmed jail, now the Four Seasons Hotel, hadn't been built then. But Goudiquet does place what we think is the great library in roughly the same area as the structure we are gradually unearthing today. But most of the palace, the great reception halls, the baths, the university, the private royal quarters, remain underground. Some we think we know about, which, again, roughly relate to Goudiquet's map, while other parts of the building seem to have disappeared even from the consciousness of the old Byzantine families who remain in the city.
Including the tunnels.
Yes, he said. We know they're there. We know it's all there, somewhere. But where?
Do you think that Dr. Server found a Byzantine building no one had ever discovered before?
She found a Byzantine skeleton that could be significant? Who knows?
He sighed.
I should have kept a closer watch on Ariadne. I didn't know how secretive she was. We all suffer from professional jealousy from time to time, but I like to think that my team share information freely. To be honest with you, Inspector, the fact that she didn't share is hurtful. It shows a lack of care for the team. In retrospect, I feel as if I never really knew Dr. Sava at all.
No. There was a pause, and then the professor said,
I don't suppose you know about the child?
Not yet, sir, no, Ikmen said. As you know, unlike in the movies and on TV, DNA tests take time.
Of course.
Professor Bosdar guided Ikmen through the main features of Goudiquet's map.
We can't be sure exactly how the great palace Goudiquet drew relates to the modern city now, but I think you will be able to see roughly where the buildings he is speculating about might be. Of course, many of the street names are different now.
Back in Ottoman times, a lot of small thoroughfares weren't named at all.
And of course Goudiquet was French, and so he may have misinterpreted names.
Of course. Thank you. Ikmen carried on looking at the map through a magnifying glass once the call was over. It looked to him as if the Sultan Ahmed Blue Mosque was right on top of what had been the private quarters of the Byzantine imperial family. So that would never be excavated. But part of the road behind the mosque had been redeveloped in recent years. The Basak al-Jadasi only had three large houses left intact now. One of them was the Negroponte house. Harker led him down the stone stairs from the garden and through the back door into the kitchen. When he'd been inside the building before, the kitchen could only be accessed from the entrance inside the house. The back door had been blocked then, and now everything was different, though not exactly the way he remembered it. Ahmed could now see the arch right in front of him, the small tunnel and the tiny door at the end of it.
The one he'd slipped through all those years ago. He turned to the old man.
How did he do it? Yanis.
It's one of his illusions, Parker said. He half smiled.
If I told you, I'd have to kill you.
It had to be, in part at least, a change in vantage point. But he'd felt odd, too. When he'd lost his temper, it had felt as if he was shouting through wool. That was his memory of it.
Did he hypnotize me, too? He asked the old man.
Parker shrugged.
What does that mean?
It means if you want them upstairs not to know about this, you'd have to keep your voice down.
Parker hadn't betrayed his master and mistress out of Muslim-Turkish solidarity, as Ahmed had hoped. He'd asked for money, and Ahmed had given him half. It was nothing, but the greed made him angry.
Do you want to go in?
Parker said.
Yes. See your wonderful things.
He was mocking him. When Ahmed had told Harker what he'd seen all those years ago, when the kitchen door had been left unlocked and he had gone inside, he'd quoted the words of the archaeologist Howard Carter, who, when he had discovered the tomb of Tutankhamun, had seen wonderful things.
I'm going to take photographs, for proof, Ahmed said.
The old man shrugged.
Be quick.
Ahmed walked towards the archway and into the small tunnel. He had to ignore the fact that the old man was a mercenary bastard for the moment. He had to get some good shots, so he could prove that it existed and that he knew about it. Once copies were in Yanis's hands, he'd have to stop playing games and sell, or be reported to the Ministry of Culture and Tourism. The house would be dismantled to make way for a very lucrative archaeological site. Except that it wouldn't, because Yanis would sell to him, rather than be compulsorily purchased by the state, and then the site would be destroyed by Ahmed. The small metal door scraped against the stone floor as he pushed it. It was dark inside. Ahmed no longer carried a lighter.
"Don't you have a candle?"
he asked.
"Yes."
He looked back into the kitchen, but the old man hadn't moved.
"Well, bring it."
He looked into the gloom again, waiting. As soon as it was illuminated, it would spring out at him, as it had done that first time, like a massive, hidden jewel. He heard the old man move towards him, and so on one level he was excited. But there was something else close to him, too, now. Something in the shadows that he couldn't see, hear, or dare move his hand to touch.
"Are you sure we're alone?"
he said to the old man, as the light from the candle behind him began to ooze into the darkness. For a second there was a colour of blood on the floor, and Ahmed smiled. So it came as a shock when Harker said,
"No."
His heart had only just begun to hammer in his chest, when there was a terrible pain in his head, and everything went dark and silent.
Chapter 21 Getting out of bed was a slow business for Mehmet Suleiman. Gonja's entire family had decamped to Gezi Park and tent-dwelling the previous day, and for the first time in years he had spent a quiet night alone with his gypsy lover. It had been blissful. She'd cooked, they'd eaten alone outside in the garden, then they'd made love and gone to sleep in each other's arms. In the calmness, he seemed to have fallen in love all over again. He looked at her sleeping and smiled. After he'd showered and shaved, Suleiman dressed quietly, careful not to wake her. But she was already stirring. Looking at him through half-closed eyes and a curtain of hair, she said,
"Is it time to go already?"
"Yes," he said. "Go back to sleep."
But she hauled herself up on her elbows.
"I must cook," she said.
"Cook?"
"If everyone is going to stay in Gezi, they'll need to eat," she said.
"The adults can fend for themselves, but the little ones and my father have to be properly fed." He shook his head, but he didn't say anything. There was no point. Gonja would look after her endless stream of relatives, usually at her own expense, whatever he said. But her devotion did irritate him. Her work suffered, and so did their relationship. That had been proven the previous night. Without the Shirakulus in tow, he didn't think about anyone but Gonja.